I'm so delighted today to present with my colleagues on applying for a Fulbright U.S. Scholar Award with some insights for applicants with disabilities. So today we'll be joined by David Levin from the U.S. Department of State, Dr. Joseph Hill from Rochester Institute of Technology, Justin Harford from the National Clearinghouse on Disability and Exchange Mobility International USA, and myself, Peter Rauchi from the Institute of International Education. So I wanted to start the presentation with some general information about the Fulbright program. The Fulbright program was established in 1946 really to expand and strengthen the relationship between people of the United States and citizens of the rest of the world. The goal of Fulbright is to really increase mutual understanding between people of the U.S. and people from citizens of other countries throughout the world. The Fulbright program is sponsored by the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs of the U.S. Department of State and is administered in part by the Institute of International Education, Council for International Exchange of Scholars. So let's look at the Fulbright program at large. What is the Fulbright U.S. Scholar Program? So with this program, we have opportunities to send faculty, administrators, professionals outside of academia to different countries throughout the world. There are more than 800 grants available in over 125 different countries. Grants include activities that can encompass teaching, research, a combination of teaching and research, and really they're tied to what is important in the host countries and how, again, the platform for this is building that mutual understanding between people of the United States and other countries. We have awards available for faculty, for administrators, for professionals outside of academia, including artists, lawyers. Really, we have so many different opportunities on the Fulbright Scholar Program, but again, it's grounded in that sense of mutual understanding. Grant lengths can, the core grants are anywhere from 2 months to 12 months with every iteration of that in between. We even offer flex grants which allow you to segment the awards into multiple short-term visits. We also have seminars for administrators that are generally 2 to 3 week opportunities. Now, looking at, again, Fulbright at large, let's look at some numbers. So we have about 380,000 grants have been administered since the inception of the program in 1946, and we send about 800 U.S. scholars award annually. Over the umbrella of all Fulbright programs, there are about 160 participating countries, and our alumni include heads of state, Nobel laureates, Pulitzer Prize recipients, MacArthur Fellows, and Presidential Medal of Freedom recipients. So indeed, that's part of the prestige of the award is the network of alumni that are Fulbrighters. And as a Fulbrighter, you're always a Fulbrighter. You're always part of that network. And who are Fulbrighters? For the Fulbright U.S. Scholar Program, the program is focused on, again, faculty, administrators, professionals outside of academia, and we have grantees from nearly 500 institutions. We represent the entire United States, all 50 states, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and Guam. Our scholars include folks from all levels and ranks of academia, tenured faculty, untenured faculty, independent scholars, scholars emeritus. We have awards specific for postdoc faculty and new faculties. We have new faculty members. We have awards that are appropriate for professionals. We have awards that are appropriate for artists, writers, independent scholars, retired scholars, as I mentioned, and coming from every type of institution, from community colleges to comprehensive research institutions and everything in between. Eligibility for the U.S. Scholar Program includes U.S. citizenship. So for the U.S. Scholar Program, you do have to be a U.S. citizen. We have the visiting scholar. If you're not a U.S. citizen, you can participate potentially in the visiting scholar program, which brings international scholars to the U.S. But for the U.S. Scholar Program, we have the eligibility criterion of being a U.S. citizen. our awards do vary in terms of their requirements, and our awards are actually really well spelled out in our materials. Some awards do require a doctoral degree or other terminal degree, whereas other awards are open to applicants with master's degrees or professionals outside of academia, artists, et cetera. We really do have alumni that span all academic disciplines, so really because we have over 470 different awards and about 800 grants under those awards, meaning that, you know, each award is an instance of an opportunity, and then each opportunity can have multiple grants. So we have a lot of opportunities to go to a country and really focus on whatever your interests are. If you're applying for a teaching award, we generally will want to see some kind of teaching experience, and that will be expressed in the award description. And then there are some new policies on previous Fulbright Scholar Grants. There is no limit to the number of Fulbright U.S. Scholar Grants that you can receive in your lifetime, but you do have to wait 2 years from the end of one grant to beginning the application for a subsequent grant. So at this time, I know that we had a bit of an audio problem. I want to see if my colleague David Levin from the State Department is on the line. David, are you with us?
Yeah, Peter, I'm here, and apologize for the glitch, but I got through.
Thank you so much, David. So I'll invite you to speak about diversity in the context of ECA, Educational and
Great.
Cultural Affairs.
Great. Thank you for that, and thank you all for tuning in. We specifically sort of designed the sequence of remarks, and then encouraging Peter to go first to talk about Fulbright in general and the Fulbright Scholar Program. The point of that being that literally any program that Peter was talking about, the whole range of opportunities for you as a scholar to participate in Fulbright, the point of this is it's open to everyone. And we take pride in that. It's part of the mandate of the Fulbright program. It's federally funded, therefore it's literally open to everyone. And in terms of the Bureau of Education and Cultural Affairs, the sponsor of the Fulbright program, we have a diversity statement. It's been in place for 20 years, has evolved over time, and specifically talks about the fact that we are consciously and concertedly reaching out to diverse audiences to participate in Fulbright, and that clearly includes people with disabilities. So we look at all these different kinds of Fulbright opportunities and say to you, if you're an individual with a disability, we encourage you to apply. We are encouraging people with disabilities to apply to the program. And what we would then say to you is, if you get selected, and it's not part of the selection process, but if you are selected and you, in fact, have a disability and would like accommodations, something done for you over and above the grant that would enable you to function successfully as a Fulbrighter and to complete your grant, to talk with us about that. In terms of what we obviously call reasonable accommodation, we do that on a case-by-case basis, working with each individual grantee, determining what your needs are, what your particular situation might be, where are you going, what are the resources available to you in the country that you're going to, what are the resources available to you that you may be bringing with you from your home institution or home organization. So the point of that is that this is part of the process, and so we encourage you to apply. We will work with you on these accommodation questions, and you'll hear further in the webinar about resources available to you, or to anyone who's looking at international exchange, whether it's Fulbright or other programs through the National Clearinghouse on Disability and Exchange, which is a project administered by Mobility International USA and funded by the State Department, as another way of demonstrating that we are working diligently to include people with disabilities in all our exchange programs. So let me leave it there and let you go on with the webinar, Peter.
Thank you so much, David, for those very important insights. And continuing that, I'd like to invite my colleague Justin Harford from Mobility International USA to speak a little bit about the National Clearinghouse and MIUSA and the resources available.
Thank you, Peter. Is this unmuted?
Yes, we can hear you, Justin. Thank you.
Great. All right, great. Well, thank you so much. It's my pleasure to address everybody today. As David mentioned, the National Clearinghouse on Disability and Exchange is a project funded by the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs and administered by the organization where I work, which is called Mobility International USA. The goal of the Clearinghouse is to increase the participation of people with disabilities in all kinds of international exchange between the United States and other countries, including programs like Fulbright. And what does that look like? Well, first of all, we do that by offering practical advice on international exchange with a disability to prospective disabled participants. So we respond to a variety of questions that people will have about international exchange, including organizing reasonable accommodations, identifying scholarships, and more. We also offer technical assistance to international exchange providers, including ECA, in order to guide them on how best to go about including people with disabilities in their programs. That can include any number of things from logistical concerns to a particular situation, such as finding accessible housing for a particular individual, or it can be more broad-based, such as, for example, how to set up policies or training practices in order to make the overall process of disability inclusion a bit smoother. Now, what we offer as far as what does that look like, first of all, to start, we have, if you go to www.miusa.org, we offer a pretty extensive online database of resources on disability and international exchange, both directed at professionals and prospective participants. You can find any number of things by putting your search or your topic in the search field. You can pull up articles related to your topic, and also if you look on the side, if you get a chance to take a look at the website after the webinar, you'll see also we have filters, so you can narrow your search results based on if you're an individual with a disability, a provider, somebody from overseas looking to come to the U.S. to do a Fulbright, for example, or somebody from the U.S. looking to do an exchange abroad. If you have more specific questions after you've reviewed the website, or even before for that matter, if it's a bit overwhelming, we also offer a free advising service. You can contact us at clearinghouse@miusa.org or using our online contact form, and you can write us any question about your particular situation. And through that, we will respond over email, or we can also talk to you over the phone, giving you specific information from our website and also assisting you with doing online research related to your particular situation. As part of the online resources, we also do feature stories of people who successfully participate in international exchange, including many stories of people who have successfully completed the Fulbright program. Those stories can be really helpful as a way to kind of give you an idea of just what it looks like to travel on the Fulbright with a disability. We also offer tips and also we do social media campaigns, such as, for example, if you look at the hashtag language access or also the hashtag hashtag access number 2 USA. Those are a couple recent examples of social media campaigns that we've done over the last couple years. Now, looking in the last slide, so as David mentioned, I mean, people will come with a lot of different questions, and if you can feel free to reach out to us. All the questions we receive are confidential. We don't go sharing the information with other people. So if you're concerned, you have something that, or if you just kind of want to get information and you're looking for a resource, you can contact us, and we get questions such as, for example, disclosure. Many people ask if they should disclose on the application process. And in the case of Fulbright, as with anything else, whether you disclose on the application is completely up to you and depending on your situation. And companies or providers cannot necessarily require you to disclose your disability on the application or, for that matter, in any part of the process. But we would recommend that after you do apply and are accepted, that you can, if you wish to have assistance from the program, we recommend disclosing your disability in order to get collaboration from the program. But in the case of the Fulbright, I'm sure you wouldn't have any worries. I believe that we've known them also to offer accommodations, not only post-acceptance, but also if you need a reasonable accommodation for the actual application process itself. Another thing to think about with disclosure, too, is that it can be, you don't have to necessarily just have it be a request for accommodations. You can, if it's part of your application, such as, for example, one of the reasons why you're so, why you're qualified for the program, you should also share that in, for example, your essay. Others are, of course, will I be accommodated abroad? Well, of course, and as David said, accommodations are taken on a case-by-case basis. And if it's your first travel experience abroad, I mean, they definitely, again, I mean, lots of support. We're available. We could also put you in touch with other people who have done the program or other exchanges who could also offer you some guidance and tips. And also, there's always, you can always expect on any program you do, whether it's Fulbright or anything else, that there will be a rather extensive orientation process before you depart. So you'll make, they'll make sure that you have every, all the information you need. And of course, why should I get a Fulbright? Well, I'll just leave that up to David's and Peter's comments. They're really, really great points about the tremendous value that Fulbright can add to your experience and also the tremendous value that you could add as a Fulbright participant with a tremendously unique perspective based on your disability experience as well as any other identities that you might have. And then how about finding accessible housing abroad or accessible living situations? That could be another question we get. And again, if everything, it's all a case-by-case basis, be a pretty straightforward process. Probably if you're talking about a country like the United Kingdom and in other places, you have to just be a bit more creative. But contacting us or checking also with your representative of your exchange program, including Fulbright, that finding accessible living situations, it can definitely, it's something that definitely can be taken care of. And with that, to give you a more particular experience, I'd like to possibly invite Peter to invite Joseph Hill, who is an alumnus of the program. We actually feature him. We interviewed him for our podcast last year. It was a great interview, and you're going to hear from him now.
Thanks so much, Justin. And indeed, I would like to introduce Dr. Joseph Hill, who's working with interpreter Nikki Cherry, to speak about his experience as a Fulbright alumnus to Italy.
Hello, thank you for inviting me to join. I am Dr. Joseph Hill, an assistant professor at RIT and the National Technical Institute for the Deaf at RIT. I'm also the director, a lab director of the Deaf Studies Lab here at NTID. I got a Fulbright, my Fulbright fellowship in 2008, and I went to Italy. At that time, I was at Gallaudet University as a PhD student, and I met many people, students who were deaf from Italy that came over to the U.S., and I met them every year. I would meet different individuals. I also met American students who went to Italy for a Fulbright experience, so I was curious about that opportunity. I decided to apply in 2007, submitted my application, and was accepted for the Italian Deaf Education Focus program. My studies at that time was language attitudes in deaf education in Italy. And that, I chose that because it related to my dissertation, which focused on how people perceive another person's use of language. For example, in America, there are many different dialects throughout the U.S., north, south, east, west, Midwest. Some people from the south look at those from the north as more snooty, and those from the north look at those from the south as less educated. So those are types of attitudes that I was looking at in the American deaf community. I've noticed there's a lot of sign variation, and I'm wondering how we perceive each other and judge each other based on language use. That was my dissertation topic. So then in Italy, I looked at language attitudes related to sign language in school or education systems. So I looked at the teacher's perspective, administration perspective, and parental perspective. They accepted my proposal to go to do this study. Now, yes, I was very concerned about communication. I'm deaf myself. I knew I would arrive and have to learn their language. I didn't know how I was going to communicate with people. I had all these thoughts in my head. But I did see American students who had gone over to Italy, did fine, so I asked them some questions ahead of time to get myself ready. And then Also, there were individuals in Italy who were responsible for the American Fulbright students, and so I contacted them, and they gave me everything I needed. For example, the orientation, well, all Fulbright students in Italy were required to go to an orientation. They found an interpreter there who was American themselves, could speak English, sign American Sign Language, and then speak Italian and sign Italian Sign Language. So for orientation, it was beautiful. I was able to participate completely with everyone. But I also had to try and prepare myself for if there was no interpreter, I would need to speak for myself, so I needed to wear a hearing aid and speak with people in spoken English. I didn't know spoken Italian. So I realized after orientation that I would be on my own. Different schools that I went to had deaf students. But my host institution, Siena School for Liberal Arts, that was my host institution, and they were wonderful to work with. I worked with the secretary of the school there, and they helped me to translate my letter from English to Italian to be able to send it to the schools I wanted to reach. I sent it to 6 different deaf schools that I interviewed people there. They also, the secretary also helped me translate from English to Italian and Italian to English. I needed to film the individuals that I was interviewing, so I had a form in their language that they could understand. But now, when I met with a deaf person, I had to sign. And before I went to Italy, I did start to learn the basics of Italian Sign Language. Once I got there, I only had 3 months to learn Italian Sign Language any way I could. And I met with deaf people in Italy. I used an Italian Sign Language dictionary book. I picked up as much as I could in the 3 months. And by the end of the 3 months, I was able to have a pretty good conversation in person. It was successful. Even though, yes, I have challenges with communication, it seems that myself and those involved on the Fulbright Committee and others were very helpful. Also with my Siena school, my host institution were great. So I very much enjoyed and appreciated that experience. When I got to Italy, everyone was very friendly. They were familiar with deaf people. They knew how to work with deaf individuals. I felt good connections with them. And really, there were almost no issues that I experienced with that. From that experience, I feel like I did learn a lot. I learned a lot about myself as a Fulbright scholar. Before going, I wasn't sure if I could do specific things, but I realized that I really could. And I also realized I needed to self-advocate for the things that I needed, for the accommodations that I might need that others might not know about. It was really a nice experience overall. And then also from that experience, I'm still in contact with the Siena School. I have been for about 4 or 5 years collaborating with them on teaching American Sign Language to Italian students that are in their program, for summer program. So I'm still in contact with them.
Okay.
And I have not ended my relationship with them. I'm still in touch with them for... I help them to recruit American students to go to the Siena School for learning Italian Sign Language and studying, etc. So I'm still assisting, even now, at RIT. I'm still doing what I can to stay in touch with them. So now I think that's all I have to say. I'll turn it over to back to Peter, and of course I'm available for questions if needed.
Thank you so much, Dr. Hill and Nikki, for giving such a great perspective on what your Fulbright grant was. I hope that everyone on the webinar is really inspired by Dr. Hill's experience and also encouraged by the materials and resources that the National Clearinghouse and Mobility International USA have available, and also encouraged by the mission of the Fulbright program, which is to increase mutual understanding. And there isn't one kind of American, there isn't one American experience, so that's why the diversity piece is there, because showing the full diversity of the U.S. does indeed increase mutual understanding between people of the U.S. and other countries. So with that inspiration and encouragement, I want to get into some of the nuts and bolts of the application process for the Fulbright U.S. Scholar Program. And this is going to be a quick overview. We have lots of resources available, so don't feel that you cannot reach out to us. We absolutely welcome you to reach out to us about any kinds of application considerations. So let's look at the application component of the process. There's an application form, which is pretty straightforward. It's nothing that you haven't experienced before. And then there's a project statement. This is the sort of heart of your proposal where you're really working to explain to us what you hope to do, how you hope to accomplish it, and what kinds of outcomes you expect out of the work that you're doing. And I think Dr. Hill gave some really great insights about different kinds of outcomes from his work. We'll want a curriculum vitae or resume, generally up to 6 pages, although some awards will take up to 8 pages, and this should be tailored to the award that you're applying to. If you're applying for a teaching award, we'll want course outlines or syllabi, 2 or 3 syllabi up to 10 pages that really demonstrate your pedagogical style, give us a sense of who you are as an instructor. If you are applying for a research award, we'll want a bibliography, which you can think of as a literature review, really the relevant literature as relates to your topic. We'll want 3 letters of reference, and we have some guidelines, specific guidelines on our website and in our application materials around who can serve as a reference provider, but generally there are 3 letters of reference required, and these are strong advocates for you and can really vouch for the fact that your project is a quality project but also connects to that Fulbright mission of mutual understanding. Then because our awards are so vast and very different, have very different requirements, there may be additional components depending on the award. There may be language proficiency requirements. Many of our awards do require a letter of invitation from a host institution overseas. And then if you're applying in a field such as the arts, architecture, journalism, creative writing, we will there's space for you to upload some work sample as well. Let's dig a little bit into the project statement. Really, this is the heart of your application. This is your opportunity to really lay out the nuts and bolts of your project. But also keeping in mind, this is also where you sort of show us your inspiration. Why Fulbright? Why this country? What is it about the work that you're proposing to do resonates with the country? And how are those outcomes going to tie into the Fulbright goal of increasing mutual understanding? Give us a sense of what you actually want to do, the specific courses that you're planning on teaching, the methods of your research, and also give us a sense of what the outcomes you expect for the activity on the grant. What is the impact going to be for your home institution in the U.S., your host institution overseas? But also, what is the impact going to be on you? What is the personal impact, the professional, the academic impact? Give us your vision for that in the project statement. And then that also, speaks to your project statement also speaks to how adaptable you are. How well do you deal with challenging situations? How can you navigate different systems of education or different styles of teaching? We want you to succeed, and we want to get a sense of your vision for how you're going to succeed at your proposed project. So that's a sort of very, very high overview of what a project statement should cover. But again, that's an integral part of your application. As I mentioned, many of our awards require letters of invitation from host institutions overseas. Some of our awards have identified potential host institutions. Others are open to universities, NGOs, research centers that you actually have to proactively find yourself. If a host is identified, we generally will write that into the award description. If a host is not identified, there are many resources to to available to you to find a potential host institution? So is there an international office on your campus, or is there a Fulbright Scholar liaison on your campus? You can also search our Fulbright Scholar directory to see your colleagues at your institution or in your field, or folks, you can even search for folks who've gone to a particular country to really sort of drill down and see, you know, some examples of alumni to throughout the Fulbright Scholar program. In many of our award descriptions, we actually will give you some indication of hosts as well, or provide some resources. In some cases, the Fulbright Commission or the U.S. Embassy in the country may be able to assist you with finding a host institution if you don't have the connections yourself, and if you're needing help connecting to a potential host institution. Letters of invitation, they're generally non-binding expressions of interest from the host institution overseas. They generally should come from the person who you will most closely be collaborating, although some countries and some awards will have some particularities around who can write the letter or what needs to go in the letter. But generally, we'll want this to be on institutional letterhead. And essentially, what the letter of invitation is, it shows that the host institution is able to accommodate your project, but also excited about accommodating your project. In terms of submitting a competitive application, we look at feasibility, we look at quality, we look at outcome, but really you want to make sure you cover all of those considerations, but also link to that Fulbright goal of promoting mutual understanding. You want to help us see why you're interested in the Fulbright program, why that country. You want to walk us through how your professional and academic background and skills link to the parameters of the award, and you want to give us a sense of cultural diplomacy and flexibility, and then also tying that into, you know, what the impact could be. And again, I want to thank Dr. Hill for giving such a great insight into what he did on his grant, and the fact that he's still in touch with the institution in Italy is a great example of some of the outcomes, some of the continuing connections that, you know, you start on your Fulbright grant. These activities don't, you are a Fulbrighter even after your grant. You're part of this great network, and you're that's part of connecting and building the mutual understanding, is continuing the conversation and continuing the connection. So I'll go a little bit over our review process and timeline. This is a very quick overview, but in general, for the Fulbright U.S. Scholar Program, the deadline is August 1st, so we do have our August 1st deadline for this year's competition coming up quickly. You want to submit your application by August 1st, and then after the deadline, we do a technical screen, and then your applications move on to peer review. Peer review is essentially two-phased review process where committees focus on the discipline of your project, review your application, and then committees focused on either the country or the region that your project involves will also review your application. We let applicants know if they've made it through the peer review process, and those that continue on go to the countries themselves, and the final decision is made by the Fulbright Scholarship Board. Generally, you'll be notified of grant approvals anywhere between February and May. Because we work with so many different countries, there isn't one general timeline, so we do give a broad range of when final approvals and notifications will come through, and then grant activity generally can start as early as June the following year. So I want to point your attention to some of the resources that we have available. Our website is quite robust, and there are many, many resources on our website. I want to just very clearly state that when you're applying for a Fulbright Scholar Award, you're not alone. There are so many different application resources. So we have very extensive application instructions, but we also give guidance on every aspect of the application, so the CV, the bibliography, the syllabi. We even give project statement guidance and sample proposals. So really, there's a lot of materials available on our website. There are many opportunities to learn about the different programs that we have on offer, including a very robust series of webinars, of which this is one, but we have webinars available for different countries, different regions, different disciplines. So really, there's a very robust series of webinars that we archive. There's also the Fulbright Scholar blog, which is a way to get inspiration and hear some more stories about the Fulbright program and the kind of things people have done on their grant. One story that we had today, of course, was Dr. Hills, but there are so many different stories available on our Fulbright Scholar blog where you can draw inspiration. Of course, there's a way to stay connected with us, My Fulbright, which is CIES2.org. That's a way for you to register your interest with us, and you can tell us, you can indicate if you're interested in particular countries or particular disciplines, and you'll receive segmented messaging from us about program developments, about different things that we have on offer, webinars, special awards that you may want to consider. So there are a lot of resources available for you on our website. Before we take questions, I want to look at some other programs under the umbrella of the Fulbright program really quickly. These are different opportunities for you and your campuses to engage with the Fulbright program and internationalize your campuses. One of our programs is the Scholar in Residence program, which brings international scholars and professionals from abroad to campuses that don't often host visiting scholars. We like to involve colleges and universities that serve underrepresented student populations. And generally, scholar and residence grantees will teach undergraduates and also provide cross-cultural international perspectives. So there's an application process for this, but this is a great way for you on your campus to get involved to proactively host international scholars. I also want to point out the Outreach Lecturing Fund. This is another opportunity to host an international scholar. This is a travel grant for Fulbright scholars, visiting scholars who are in the U.S., and this grant is available to them for short-term teaching opportunities on U.S. campuses. This is institutionally driven application by host institutions in the U.S., and scholars generally will meet, lecture, and exchange ideas with faculty, community organizations, and in many cases, sometimes K-12 schools as well. We have an online scholar directory for a list of active scholars in the U.S., and you can contact us at olf@iie.org if you'd like more information about these wonderful short-term opportunities for scholars to come to your campuses in the U.S. Then I want to briefly mention some other Fulbright programs. We have a wide variety of programs under the Fulbright umbrella in the Fulbright family. We have the Arctic Initiative, the Specialist Program, the Fulbright U.S. Student Program, the Distinguished Awards in Teaching, the Fulbright Hayes Awards. Today we have focused on the Fulbright U.S. Scholar Program, but that's one of many different programs available in the Fulbright family. At this point, I want to open the floor for some Q&A. So if you have questions, please do chat them into the chat function of the webinar. But I want to leave up this slide for you to stay in touch with us. So certainly you can join my Fulbright, as I've mentioned, CIES2.org. That's a way for you to indicate your interest in particular countries or particular disciplines and receive segmented messaging from us about different program developments. You can absolutely email us at scholars@iie.org. And if you have questions that we don't get to during the webinar or questions come up that you didn't think of during the webinar, absolutely feel free to reach out to us. You can visit our website to learn all about the Fulbright U.S. Scholar Program. We even have a referral program where you can refer your colleagues to us if you think some of your colleagues might be interested in considering a Fulbright grant. Of course, we're well represented across all platforms of social media, so Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, many, many ways for you to connect with us and to stay in touch with us. And at this point, what I'd like to do is open the floor to any questions that folks may have. So if you want to take just a few moments to chat in your questions, feel free to find the chat function of the webinar, the same place where you did the sound check, and let us know if you have any questions that we can answer for any of us. I also, before we take any questions, I do want to thank our panelists today. I want to thank David Levin from the State Department. I want to thank Dr. Joseph Hill from RIT and his interpreter, Nikki Cherry, who he worked with today. I want to thank Justin Harford from the National Clearinghouse, from Mobility International USA, who works with the National Clearinghouse. So I'm going to take just a second to scroll through any questions that folks have, but feel free to chat any questions that you have. We had a really good question about a particular country. I'm interested in a Spanish-speaking country. Is there a team member or is there someone I can speak to that might be able to, that I could talk to about a, that I could talk to about, you know, a particular country? And absolutely. So in our catalog of awards, and we'll send a link to that to everyone who registered for the webinar, there's always, at the bare minimum, a staff member or a team member associated with each particular award, each particular country. So always, always feel free to reach out to us if you have questions about things that aren't clear or if you want to discuss awards, any particular award, in more detail. We have a great question. Should you disclose your disability in requesting an institutional affiliation? Is it wrong not to do so? I'd like to invite my colleagues, anyone who feels strongly about answering that question. I mean, my answer is, you know, there are variables that you may want to consider, but I'd like to hear from my colleagues who have thoughts about that.
Peter, I'm happy to address that. This is David.
Thank you, David.
So there's no right or wrong answer. Some people will actually talk about their disability within their actual application. And so that's part of who I am. It's part of you as readers, reviewers will get a better sense of who I am, my identity. So they'll include it in their application. Other people may include it, may say, well, I'm not going to include it in my application, but it would come up at some point perhaps when I'm completing my medical form. And we would learn perhaps about your disability there. Other points in time, people would simply say to us, either I'm applying and I have a disability, or I've applied, I've received the grant, and I have a disability. So we're talking about different sort of points along the timeline. And other people simply choose not to do it at all. They say, I'm can work with my own disability overseas. I don't need accommodations, so I don't necessarily need to tell anyone at all. There's different sort of points of view. Some people don't do it because they say that I don't want this to negatively affect my application. We make a point about saying that with Fulbright, we do not take this into consideration in terms of your application per se, your academic qualifications, your need for accommodations, and your disability would be a separate issue we deal with, a separate matter we deal with, would not be part of our selection process. So we want to, you know, convince you of that. But like I said, there's no specific point in time when you should or you shouldn't disclose. It's sort of really up to you and your individual situation.
This is Joseph. Yes, I agree with David. It's up to you to disclose or not. I did disclose that I'm deaf because for the Fulbright program that I was working with the Fulbright Committee in Italy specifically for deaf education is the award. So I felt it was beneficial to disclose that because that was to my advantage. They need more deaf applicants to come. So I felt that was to my advantage. Also, they knew that me being deaf, they would be able to provide me what I needed and to help me with my studies there. And I felt that that would be more successful. And, you know, I think those who I knew that went and came here as Fulbright scholars were really, it was beneficial. I didn't think it would be a bad thing, but it depends on which country and who you'll be working with as to what you'll want to do.
This is Justin. I just one final thing to add is also, this is kind of a unique program in that you also have to develop a relationship with the possible host institution and get them to work with you as well. And so if you were concerned about how you would disclose your disability to them, to the sponsoring institution, but there's a few things to that. I mean, apart from what's already been shared, I mean, first of all, there's the compelling fact that you are coming with funding so they don't have to provide extra support for you. Hopefully these are kind of institutions that people have already got relationships with, but if not, using some of Fulbright's resources, I think you can help. Fulbright can be a great sort of, they can sort of vouch for you as far as your abilities. Another thing, too, to consider is if you contact Mobility International, we do have over 2,300 alumni around the world, and some of them might offer ins for you to connect with a host institution in another country.
We have another question about sort of in-country considerations. So will Fulbright support expenses related to in-country travel, example, a mobility-impaired scholar who is not able to use public transportation? So I invite my colleagues with insights about that to share any insights with the audience.
Yeah, this is David Levin again. Yes, we would look at your needs both in order to work with you through the process, getting you to the country that you're going to, but also look at your needs, while you're there. We would look at what's your particular Fulbright assignment, what are the parameters of that, and then how can we be of assistance to you into helping you successfully complete your assignment, and that might include, a need to travel through other parts of the country. So yes, again, we would look at this case by case as part of the reasonable accommodation that we would provide you. And I don't know, maybe Joseph has some examples of what was done in his case in Italy.
Yeah, this is Joseph. Really, my accommodation needs are communication. And because I worked with the deaf program there in Italy, most of the time I had individuals who worked as interpreters there available at the deaf school. And for interviews or discussions or meetings with someone, I typically had an interpreter available. So it worked out for me. But outside of the school locations, I was on my own. And most of the time I was successful. I was able to figure out how to communicate with people, right back and forth. Or often I would tell them I'm deaf or sign that I'm deaf, and they would try and gesture with me and be very friendly overall. But, yeah, I did have to work a little bit harder for myself, trying to understand where I'm going, where I'm staying. I did have additional work on my part and responsibility, but it really worked out really, really well, and I can't answer anything for the mobility issues because that doesn't relate to me.
Thank you. One other comment, too. I mean, this is kind of a clarification to David. I mean, sometimes what we've seen is you'll have people with mobility impairments where they're on their campus and their school doesn't pay for a taxi or a bus because that's kind of considered to be something that's within the scope of what that person would cover on their day-to-day, not really a reasonable accommodation, whereas we've seen that change in some cases overseas. For example, if you're in Mexico City, the buses might not be accessible, but you might need to use taxis, which might incur an extra expense for you. But it sounds like, David, you were saying that's kind of a case-to-case basis.
That's right. That's right.
Great. Thanks for sharing those insights. We have a few more questions about the application that I'll take. I know we went a little bit over, but I want to thank everyone again for it. We did have a little audio issue in the beginning of the webinar, so thanks everyone for your patience, and I'll answer these questions that just came in. What happens if you change institutions or leave the institutions you were where you're working when you apply, you know, we'll get your CV when you apply. So your CV should be up to date and reflect, you know, the state of your career when you hit submit on the application. But we understand that things change in between the start of an between the submission of an application and, you know, when you'd actually start your grant. So if you were conferred the grant, you know, we would check in with you, reassign advisors to you that help you, you know, work with you through your grant. And, you know, that's something that we can easily accommodate. So not a problem if you changed institutions between when you have applied and when you start your grant. Then a great question is there an age limit to apply, or how long it's been since you've received your PhD? And the answer is no. We do not, age is not a factor in consideration. That being said, there may be some awards that want postdocs to apply, and they'll want someone who has recently received their PhD. So if you've had your PhD for a while, you may not be eligible for some of those early career awards. But in terms of an age limit, there is no age limit. So at this point, it doesn't look like we have any further questions. I really do want to thank everyone for joining today. I'm delighted to have presented and worked with everyone who presented today. I want to again thank David Levin from the State Department, Dr. Joseph Hill from Rochester Institute of Technology, and Nikki Cherry, also from Rochester Institute of Technology, Justin Harford from Mobility International USA. We're delighted to present this opportunity, and again, I want to thank everyone, wish you a wonderful weekend, and encourage you to submit your applications by August 1st. Thanks so much, everyone.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.